fantastic feeling.
Well, I was absolutely elated. And it's one of those things, there are certain things, historical events that occur that you know exactly where you were and what you were doing at the moment you heard it. You heard the news of some historic event. And I know, I can remember, for instance, where I was and what I was doing when the Japanese, it was announced that the that Sunday, December 7th, when it was announced the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Imagine that. The Railroad Days.
No.
Oh, attack Pearl Harbor.
No. That was 1941. I was lying. I was in a rooming house I lived in on Church Street in Ann Arbor. I was lying on my bed on Sunday afternoon listening to the New York Philharmonic. Sunday afternoon when the broadcast was interrupted to announce that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. I remember exactly how I felt. I remember where I was when I heard the news that the Roosevelt had died. I remember exactly the instant that I heard about the dropping of the bomb. I remember where I was when Kennedy was assassinated. Exactly who told me and how I found out, I mean, what the exact circumstances were. So these things are very, very dramatic. And Israel, where I was, I remember exactly where I was when the vote in the UN was announced.
Have you been to Israel?
Yes, I was there in 63, as a matter of fact.
Professionally? Or?
Yeah, I was there when I was in Israel. When I was in Greece, I was visiting professor. This was after my wife had died. My daughter convinced me to stay. I wanted to go home. And my daughter said, you've got a responsibility. You have to stay and finish what you started. And it wouldn't be good for me to go home. And so I stayed. And as I had some people I had met who were working on polio in Israel, and they heard I was in Greece, and they invited me to come visit, be a guest in Israel. And I took the opportunity then to take along with me the professor of who was head of microbiology and clinical infectious diseases there, a guy named Matusis, because Moutousis. I took him and his wife with me to, they went with me and my daughter, and my son was in Greece by that time. It was in the summer. He had finished in school and come, and all of us went to, flew to Israel, and I did that, and they were very happy to do that because Israel is always interested in making connections with networking with different countries, and this is one they had absolutely no contact with. So the professor was very interested in doing that, and he was a guest too of the Hadassah Medical School.
Is that where you were?
Yeah.
In Jerusalem.
Yeah. And the interesting thing to me was that one of the holdups on the date, he had to make sure that he could get another passport. Because he had to get for himself and his wife a second passport. Because at that time, if he had Israel stamped on a visa to Israel stamped on his Greek passport, he would not be allowed into any Arab countries. Mm-hmm. And so rather than this was horrifying to me. I didn't realize that this was going on, and it was educational because he went to the trouble of getting, and the Greek Foreign Office issued him a separate passport for travel to Israel.
Have you made other trips to Israel?
No, that's the only time I've been.
That's a dumb question. Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about your family? Vacations, family vacations.
Well, being in Pittsburgh, first, I can remember our first vacations were up to Lake Erie when we rented a house that the Salts had rented on Lake Erie. I can't remember where exactly what the town was, but it was east of Cleveland. But we rented a house there after they rented it for a couple of weeks a year, and then we rented it. And we did that for a couple of years till there was a big hurricane, and the whole cliff fell over.
Oh, my
God. So there was a big storm which hit. And then we started going to, and every summer we would go to Long Beach Island. We'd go to Beach Haven. And we were introduced to that by some neighbors across the street, Dr. Gilbert Sains and his family. They had been going there, and they suggested that we try it, so we went there. Then my vacations were mostly connected with meetings, international meetings. I would have a meeting in one country or another, and my wife and I would go. We never went with the children didn't come, but we would take our vacations and associate in conjunction with meetings I had to attend one place or another, either in this country or abroad, and then just extend the time and travel. So we've been to a lot of places, and also I've been invited to meetings in Japan. I was part of a U.S.-Japan exchange program. I was there for a couple of weeks. Visited Taiwan, and I had a delegation. I went to the Soviet Union, but that wasn't vacation, I'll tell you.
What year was that?
That was 1972.
Oh, wow.
That was not a vacation. And more recently, since my son has family, starting, I don't know how many years ago, first at Long Beach Island in New Jersey, so it must be for the last, since his oldest child is now going to be 14, and we did this when he was a baby, so it must be for 14 years. For the last 14 years, we've been going on vacation with my son and his children and my daughter.
That's the whole family.
The whole family goes for 2 weeks together for 2 weeks. And we did it for a couple of years at Long Beach Island, and for the last 10 years, for 10 years, we did it at the Outer Banks. We rented a house at the Outer Banks. Now that the children are getting bigger, older, and more capable of doing many other things, last year all of us went to Jackson Hole for 2 weeks for vacation. And the summer of 1993 will be the first year we're not doing this together, because they are now going to a dude ranch or something in Jackson Hole that they found, and I have no interest in going to a dude ranch. So as the children get older, they begin to want to do different things, and so I think that phase is over.
But you still go to Cleveland to, babysit since they're teenagers, but you mentioned earlier that
we've done that several times, and we're actually going to do this on the 4th of March. We're going to stay with the children for 10 days. And my son and his wife are going, all expenses paid for both of them, to a meeting in Sicily.
It's not bad. Mm.
And so this is something that we look forward to very much, because we have them all to ourselves, and they have us all to themselves. And it was very flattering to me the other day talking to my son. He said the trip was in doubt. It actually had been scheduled for the year that the Gulf War broke out. After the Gulf War broke out, and so the meeting was canceled, and so it was rescheduled now for this summer, and this spring, and but it was in doubt in the last month whether they would pay his wife's expenses, all the arrangements. The Italians are very lax in communicating these things, and so he told his kids that it looks like they're not going to go, and they all said at the same time, he said, "What? You've got to go." And he said it wasn't very flattering to him and his wife, but it was very flattering to us. So everybody looks forward to this period of having one another all by themselves. It says a lot.
Now, Dr. on your CV, we have a listing of all your honors and appointments. And we won't go talk about them all, but are there any that you really feel good about? any honors, any awards that was special?
Well, I think that being elected president of a society that that represents my special field of interest, that was very nice.
And what was the
American Society for Virology, the president for elected office, and by my peers, that's always nice. That's the nicest honor you can get. I've had, you can read through there, I've had various
well, that I know, things,
and,
but
that's the one that really is pretty outstanding.
And you have been department chairman.
I was a department chairman at, from 1967 to 1989.
So that was not a rotating department
chair. No.
Some of
the others. No, the medical school, they don't know. They're not rotating.
I see. Okay. Do you have any unfinished business?
Oh, yeah. There's more, I mean, for research, there's more unfinished business than finished business, because there's more unknown than known. So there's no, I mean, not, that'll never be finished. And right now I'm working on project which has great potential, and I'd like to see something done. But in many ways, after it's a very interesting phenomenon, because after you do the work and everything goes well, then you have to depend on other forces picking it up and trying it on a scale where you see whether it really works in the real world. And so right now we've done. Well, we have, I'm not going to go into details, but we have have done a project which has ended up in proposing a way to prevent influenza other than vaccination, that is using something as a virus as an antiviral, which is the principle, using a weakened virus to interfere with a disease-producing virus. It's a principle that we've been that my lab has been pushing for a long time, and now we've gone through through not only lab experiments and animal experiments, but we finished a human trial sponsored by the NIH, which was done at the University of Rochester, and we're just about to publish that. But now it's up to Pharmaceutical House to pick this up and try it. And there's one pharmaceutical house that is supposed to make a decision in early March whether they're going to spend the money to do this. I'm afraid that with the
that was my next question.
I'm afraid with the latest news about cost containment for pharmaceutical companies, for the controversy that's going on about the vaccine, the mass vaccination programs, and the profit. That they may not be very anxious to take on a new project, but we'll see.
Now you say this is not, these people do not have to be inoculated?
No, this is...
How are they going to get?
Well, it doesn't eliminate the need for vaccination. No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. So vaccine gives long-term protection.
Okay.
What we're talking about is... What if you had a drug that if there was an outbreak, if a patient came down in a nursing home or in a hospital, and they weren't the staff and the patients were not vaccinated, what that you could stop the slow down and stop the epidemic. That's what we're after, or in the military, or in a school. Institutionalized people, any institutionalized population. And what we've done is a first trial in humans, and it actually works. And what the principle is that we have a what's called an attenuated live virus, which grows but doesn't produce any symptoms. And this virus is able to, when it gets into a cell that has a virulent virus, it's able to inhibit the growth of the virulent virus and suppress symptoms. And we've tested it now in lab models, in animal models, and in humans, and it seems to work. And now it has to be, it was only done in in 30. It was done in over 30 people, and divided into two different groups. And now it has to be done on a trial which is much bigger, to the, what we call phase one trials. Although this doesn't have to be done phase one trial because this virus is not toxic, it doesn't produce any symptoms. It's been used in many different people for vaccine purposes. And also, it would be very important if there were what's called a shift, a sudden shift. In other words, if a new flu came around that nobody had ever seen before, like the Asian epidemic or the Hong Kong epidemic, where there's no matter whether you're vaccinated or not, you're susceptible because it's a completely different virus. We found that the virus that we're using will inhibit any influenza virus.
It will inhibit any?
Any influenza A, no matter what its source, including all the, and we've tested all the animal strains from all different species of animals, which you know have their own influences, and all the human strains. It doesn't make any difference what the immunizing type is.
So this really would be very, very important.
Yeah, and it's also applicable, the principle is applicable to other diseases. And people are starting to think about this kind of approach to even AIDS, where the vaccines they've been using are very disappointing. It doesn't seem they're getting anywhere with the vaccine studies. They're very disappointing. And AIDS presents a real problem because the virus really changes. So if you use a vaccine, the virus is so mutable that in the same patient you can get different antigenic viruses that are so different that the antibody against one doesn't protect against the other. Even in the same individual, there are multiple kinds of virus. It's so highly mutable. So some approach like this has complications and would have to be done very, very carefully. But unless there's some miracle drug that comes up, there have to be attempts to try to there have to be some open-mindedness about seeing what could be done.
In view of the current situation with the pharmaceutical houses, have you any feelings that you have, how have your relationships been in previous years with developing, with dealing with pharmaceutical houses?
First dealings I had were with the polio vaccine, and those were all very, very, they all came here and learned how to do it. I had very close interactions with most of the pharmaceutical houses that made polio vaccine at the time. I was a consultant for Pfizer for many years, very good relations with Pfizer company, when they were interested in biologicals, which they're not anymore. They've gone out of the business like many other companies. And I've had now I'm trying to have interactions, and it's very difficult because I don't handle these things personally, because they're handled through the university, because these, now we have a patent on our procedure, and so the university owns the patent, and they have a what's called an Office of Intellectual Property, and they do all the negotiating. I don't take care of these things. It's out of money.
You mentioned that you had an NIH grant for this work.
Yeah.
Do you, or your lab, are you having more difficulty getting grants than in previous years?
Well, I have had continuous funding from the NIH since 1957. I've never had a break.
Continuous?
Mm-hmm. Since 1957.
That's unbelievable.
So the present grant is in its 28th year, just with the same number. So I have one of the oldest numbers. You don't find too many older than that. And I'm very glad that I've been able to, and thankful that I've been able to maintain productivity for this long period of time. The average life of NIH grantees, you know, in the grant scheme is less than 5 years. I mean, you take all the grants and average how long they have them, it's 5 years or less. People stay in the game. So I'm very grateful that I could stay in this long. My grant goes till 1995 now, which would be its 30th year. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to reapply or not.
Do you have students on this grant, graduate students?
I still have two graduate students.
Mm-hmm. At the PhD level?
Mm-hmm. I have two PhD students. One is in the process of finishing up his thesis and is going to go to Harvard for his postdoctoral training. The other one has another year or so more to go.
Do you have some idea how many PhD students you have?
Not too many. I haven't put out a large number. I've never believed in having a big lab group, because I always wanted to be involved. And when you want to be involved in what's going on, and you also have administrative duties, it's best not to have too big a lab group, because then things get away from you. You really don't know what's happening. And all the years I was chairman, I never actually stopped working in the lab. So I always had a project that I myself was doing with my hands. My principle was that in the mornings I was in the lab, the afternoon was Caesar's. So if I could arrange it, of course there were emergencies and things came up that I couldn't be rigid about it. But in general, that was how I kept my hand in and kept myself active in the lab. So I still work in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I never stopped, actually.
Have any of your students, were they all American or some from other countries? What have they done?
They're all American. They're all American citizens, and they're all in this country.
They are.
Yeah, they're all working in this country. Mm-hmm. And I've had some foreign postdocs. My students have been all U.S. citizens.
Is there anything else you want to tell us? Is there anything you can think of now?
Well, Dr. Younger mentioned wives, and we've clearly only covered the first wife.
Well, we talked about Raina Clark.
Yeah.
But tell us about Raina's PhD.
No, Dr. Younger said he wanted to say something about both wives in the beginning. Did you?
Well, I just wanted to tell you about. I told you about my first wife. And,
did we have her name?
Yeah.
I don't think we did.
Okay.
Tell us her name.
Her maiden name was Tula, T-U-L-A.
And what was her last name?
That was her first name.
Oh.
T-U-L-A. And her last name was Liakakis. L-I-A-K-A-K-A-K-I-S.
Liakakis. Do you want to tell us any more about Raina? I do know that she has a PhD.
Yes. She got a PhD a couple of years ago. And now she's
at Pitt.
Well, she doesn't have a formal appointment at Pitt.
She
got PhD at Pitt. But now she's become an expert in the field of industrial imagery, industry in art.
Okay.
You want to
explain a little bit?
Well, you'll have to go to the show that's going to. She's curating a show. The exhibition that's going to be opening in June at the Fine Arts Gallery at Pitt. And this is being done in conjunction with a national meeting that's being held here of the Society of Industrial Archaeology. And the exhibition is being co-sponsored by the Society for Industrial Archaeology by Pitt. And it's financed by funded by the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. And so she's busily upstairs working on the catalog.
Is there anything, if you had to do it over again, that you'd do differently in your life?
You don't want me to give you an answer off the top of my head.
We have to come back.
Well, then you have to turn off the machine and let me think. Because professionally, I wish I had been more cynical and more realistic and less idealistic when I was with Jonas Salk.
I think that the world would have been a better place for it.
Please elaborate on that.
Personally, in my personal life, I don't really have, you know, see, what you ask is, do you have any regrets, is another way of putting your question. That's really, how else can you interpret a question like that? Would you do something differently? That's saying, I mean, I interpret that to mean, do you have any regrets, and if you had to go back again, would you do things differently?
Yeah, like in my next life, I'm going to marry a rich man, you know, send my children to private school. How about you?
Well, I did send my son to private school. I went to Exeter, and so went to Shadyside in Exeter, and Swarthmore, and the Case Western Reserve, so I did my duty there. So no, I don't have any regrets about that. I don't know. I'm not one to have regrets, because my desires have been fulfilled. The things that I had no control over, like people dying, like diseases that killed my wife, I had no control over that. I felt very frustrated, but that's something that was. That I regret that was out of my control. So there are things that are out of control. What was in my control, I always managed to make the right decision for my career. Now, I'm not one of these people that planned ahead. I mean, it's amazing to me when I think about my career that I never was one of these cold-blooded planners who wrote down a list of things that I want to do and what next year or year after I want to do this in life or so forth. It just, opportunities when I needed them, when I was ready for them, appeared for me. Whether this is serendipitous or whether this was just the flow of my own desires and where I happen to be and how I happen to handle them. But it never was conscious on my part. And that's why, perhaps, I'm unusual among American professional scientists in one place so long. This is not the usual picture. Most of my colleagues move several times in their career. But people have asked me, how come you stayed in Pittsburgh so long? How come you've been here all these years? And my answer to that always has been, is that every time I felt a change was needed, that somehow Pittsburgh and the University of Pittsburgh always made it available to me what I wanted. I mean, for instance, becoming a chairman, I was perfectly happy being a professor in a department and not being a chairman. But then I found I was doing all the work of the chairman that I had that had preceded, that I was working under. I was doing most of they were completely uninterested in being chairman, and found somebody who was responsible, would do things. So I decided maybe I should become a chairman, rather I'm doing the work anyway. And so I started to let it be known I wanted to be a chairman, and I went and interviewed at several places and was negotiating with several places when suddenly Pitt said, why are you going to leave? Why don't you stay here? Well, what do you want? And so I stayed. Because what was the point of moving if I got what I wanted here? I saw no virtue in it, and I've never regretted staying here. And the university has always allowed me to do what I want. And now they've conferred a kind of honorific title on me. And
what's that title?
Called Distinguished Service Professor. There are not too many of them at Pitt. Tom Starzl and Bernie Fisher and Tom Detry and medical school. That's maybe Peter Safar. So, it's been
I've never felt I didn't get what I wanted or the recognition of Pitt. That's it.
Okay. Thank you.